Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
Am I going to be the one who kind of lies onto the duvet for a week feeling like death and then, you know, carries on with my life? Am I going to be the one where I've got such an intense pneumonia that within 7 or 8 days, my oxygen saturation has fallen from 98-99% to, 80-82%, and I feel like I can't breathe, and I'm turning blue, and I'm, ambulanced to hospital, where I either make it or I don't? Or am I going to be one of the ones who gets through and survives, but comes out with long COVID and, wondering, when am I going to feel normal again? How could there be this incredibly diverse array of outcomes? And a lot of that is diversity of immune response.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. The show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor. I study nutrition and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. Today, I'm speaking with Professor Danny Altman from Imperial College about COVID-19 and the post-viral syndrome associated with its infection, currently referred to as long COVID. It's part of our long COVID series, and not a lot is known about this chronic condition, which for some people is absolutely debilitating, and it could also affect up to 500,000 people in the UK or more. And we really need to further research this condition and build the infrastructure to tackle it. Professor Altman heads a lab at the Hammersmith Hospital campus of Imperial. Key research interests are the immunology of infectious disease, including severe bacterial infections, Zika virus, and chikungunya virus, something that we refer to in the podcast where he can pronounce it better than me. Other projects focus on autoimmune disease, including the role of the microbiota in rheumatoid arthritis and autoimmune immunotoxicity in cancer immunotherapy. Today, you're going to learn a lot. We refresh our memories about what we know about COVID. Danny gives us a quick recap about the parts of the immune system, how the virus enters cells via the ACE2 receptor, which is found on multiple sites of the body, hence why we have a plethora of different symptoms associated with COVID-19 infection. We talk about the inflammasome, what it is, why it's useful, and what goes wrong with the virus. The over 50 symptoms documented to do with long COVID, including most popularly fatigue, headache, loss of attention, and shortness of breath. We talk about the theoretical mechanisms on long COVID, multi-organ fibrosis, persistent undetected infection that needs to be cleared, as well as the similarity between autoimmune and inflammatory conditions as well. There isn't a clear correlation between the severity of acute disease if you are unlucky enough to contract COVID and the long-term issues associated with what we call currently long COVID syndrome. But the cyclical nature could point to an autoimmune-like picture, and we go into this in a bit more detail as well. We also look at parallels between other post-viral syndromes such as EBV and post-Ebola, And we have a slight digress conversation about diagnostic uncertainty in medicine and how we actually approach that. And perhaps, you know, we really need to be thinking about the ways in which we see patients where investigations are all normal, that there isn't anything to point to a clear diagnosis. And instead of thinking, well, this is a psychogenic, it's psychogenic in its foundation, we need to be thinking about the other possibilities and what we do not know and how we deal with that in medicine as well. And we round off our conversation talking about the vaccine variants to coronavirus and why Danny doesn't believe that it's going to be a cyclical vaccine schedule and it could behave slightly different. But everything is up for discussion here, and I'm sure that many of us are going to be proven wrong during this period of time. I really hope this clarifies some understanding about long COVID, and we will be doing some other episodes on this really important topic as it pertains to how we treat other systemic inflammatory diseases as well. And there are certainly going to be some nutrition and lifestyle changes that perhaps are going to be useful for this and other conditions, although Danny wasn't able to offer any on this occasion, and I understand his reservation for doing so because a lot of it is anecdotal at this point. But we will see for now and watch this space. But for now, I really hope you enjoy this conversation with Professor Danny Altman. Danny, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
Great. I thought before we go into the main focus of our conversation, I would love to know what drew you to immunology and a bit about your career thus far.
Oh, well, sort of hard to say. So I've been an immunologist for a frighteningly long time that would make me sound very, very old. Because I've just loved it and lived and breathed it 7 days a week. If it's possible, since I turned up to start my PhD September 1980 at Bristol University, you know, the sort of big chief was called Tony Epstein, who was the person, or one of the people who discovered Epstein-Barr virus.
Oh, wow. Which
was, you know, the first virus that we knew of that causes human cancers. And so I turned up on day one, and they said, "Why don't you seem to like T cells and immunology? Why don't you spend 3 years doing something on that?" And I've never really stopped since. And you know, and I absolutely love it, and you know, live it and breathe it.
Wow! I mean, it must be quite amazing having had such an eminent immunologist, someone to look up to.
Well, you know, there were you know, lots of great people there that I could talk about for many hours. You know, it was just a very exciting place, and somehow different strokes for different folks, but sort of academia somehow appealed to me. The idea that there was you know, all this exciting knowledge out there and all this stuff being discovered. So around that time, it was one of the many times that the Nobel Prize in Medicine had been awarded to immunologists. So somebody called Rolf Zinkernagel won the Nobel Prize around then for discovering how T cells recognize antigens. And it just felt like a very exciting world somehow.
Well, I mean, it is a really exciting world. I mean, we've spoken on the podcast before about immunology and the system and how it pertains to things like cancer, but also obviously with what's going on right now. I wonder, before we go into the main focus of our conversation, we could do almost a bit of a primer around immunology for the folks listening at home. So what do we mean by the immune system, and how would we partition it into the various cell types?
You know, we've all got some grasp of human biology, and especially this year, I think we've all kind of come on in leaps and bounds. But I think one of the things that's perplexing to people is that if I spoke to you about your respiratory system, you'd kind of know I meant lungs. And if I said cardiac, you'd know I meant heart. And if I said central nervous system, you'd know I meant brain. But where does the immune system live? So that's the first kind of confounder, because, you know, what are we talking about? We're talking about the things that white blood cells do to protect you against the outside world, which, if you want to be you know, complex animal living on this planet, is an enormous challenge. And so obviously those white blood cells, the clue is in the name, are whizzing about in your blood. But they're also doing things in quite a kind of complex choreographed way in particular bits of your body. So there's your spleen and your thymus and your lymph nodes and your tonsils and all these kind of lymphoid organs where they actually have to kind of get together and talk to each other and make things happen. So that's the first thing to know, that it's you know, it's kind of buzzing around your body, but sometimes localizing particular places to do fancy things. And the other thing that gets us really excited is just, you know, the sheer complexity of it. That, you know, if I got you to look down a microscope at some blood and we'd separated out the white blood cells, it possibly wouldn't look that exciting, because they'd look like little tiny white round blobs of you know, slightly different shapes and sizes. And yet we could then do fancy things to them to identify them and light them up with different colored antibodies. And I'd be able to show you that those things that look like one type of white blob actually contained populations of tens of thousands of different cells protecting you in different ways with totally different genetic programs. And, you know, we'd be off.
And broadly speaking, if you look at the immune system, which you've described, then just to give an idea of the magnitude of it to the listeners, what are the main parts of the immune system?
Yeah. So you know, if you were to sort of rewind from my tens of thousands of different types, and you know, go back a little way, there's lots of ways that immunologists like to kind of cut and slice this. But for me, one of the most useful starting points is to talk about some of the cells that look the simplest, the lymphocytes, which are the little sort of white round ones. And they, especially for immunologists, come in two different flavors. So since the 1970s, they've been called B cells and T cells. And the B cells are the ones that make your antibodies. And the T cells make lots of other kind of chemicals, lots of other cytokines, and also are sometimes known as killer cells, because if a virus, or for that matter, a cancer is in your cells, they'll recognize it and they'll kill it and stop it spreading. We mainly get excited about B cells and T cells when we're not getting excited about all the other types of white blood cells, because B cells and T cells are kind of, as we've seen in all the discussion over COVID, are kind of solving the problem in different ways, because a B cell can make this kind of soluble molecule, an antibody that whizzes around and soaks up bits of virus, hopefully before they can get into your cells and infect you or kill you. And the T cell is doing something slightly different. It's both recognizing the virus has got in and making lots of stuff to kind of boost the immune response and boost the B cells and get them activated. And it's also saying, help, I've spotted some viruses, actually made it into some cells. It's actually penetrated the defenses. Let's kill those cells before it spreads. So it's both of those halves. And, you know, like I said, that's been my life really for the last several decades.
Yeah. I mean, it's fantastically complex as well. I mean, I know you're pretty prolific on Twitter, and I've gone through some of the articles that you've retweeted and stuff. And I'll be honest, I get a couple of pages in, and I'm having to
look at
the number differently.
Yeah. I'm having to look up a lot of the definitions. But I think that's great to sort of even pictorially represent in people's minds exactly how the immune system is and what the different types of cells are. And also, you know, we've heard a lot about the immune system and the gut. And a lot of people have heard various proportions of the number of immune cells that are located in your gut. Can you talk a bit more towards that concept?
It's a subject I love talking about. So in non-COVID times, a big part of the day job in our lab is people looking at the interaction between diet, gut microbiota, education of immune cell populations, things made by those gut microbiota and by the immune cell populations, and disease outcomes. And for me, disease outcomes in that sentence means for us anything from susceptibility to autoimmune and inflammatory diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, or in another project in the lab, cancer patients being treated with antibodies to attack their cancers, and how they come out of it very differently depending on differences in their gut microbiota. You know, we're sort of passionate advocates of that field, So put simply, what it would say is that your microbiota is almost like another organ or another system in your body. It's part of who you are. It's almost a bigger part of your body than the human cells, the sort of microbiological cells within you. And in the olden days, when I was a student, we used to think that they were kind of there by accident or not noticed or not relevant. And now we think they're an absolutely intrinsic part of who you are and why you're different. And they're in constant dialogue with different parts of your body, but especially your immune system, kind of establishing a set point. Is it going to be pro-inflammatory? Is it going to be anti-inflammatory? Is it going to be good at immunity to cancers? Is it going to, you know, let the cancers fly by? What's it going to do? Couldn't be a more exciting time than it is at the moment for decoding those interactions, not least for the obvious reason that for so much of the medical research we do, the answer is something very complex and expensive and intractable and hard to deliver. Whereas when you do microbiota research, the answer might be to do with dietary change or changes to use some antibiotics or quite tractable things. So, so we love it.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you speak to any, I'm not too sure if it's been looked into too, but if there are any differences in the response to COVID based on the microbial population of the patient at all? Has that been looked into?
The beginnings of a few studies and lots of people setting up to look at it. You know, there's so many things to look at in COVID, and we've been very impatient, haven't we? Because we've gone a year from a standing start to knowing almost more about infection immunity in this infection than about, you know, any others on planet Earth. You know, and why wouldn't you in the current situation? So yes, when there are so many immunologists who love sequencing and characterizing microbiota species, that's ongoing as well. And there've been a few reports, and there will be more. You know, it wouldn't be very hard to draw the diagram, because as you know very well, people on planet Earth have very different species of microbiota in their bodies, and in very simplistic terms, there are goodies and baddies, and ones that send your immune system in good protective directions and ones that don't. And that certainly will have implications, amongst many other things, in COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we go into the chronic aspect of COVID, I wonder if we could probably we could touch on the acute side of the infection with COVID-19, from how the virus infects a cell to its viral replication stage, and then to the acute effects of COVID.
If we all can think back to how we were thinking about COVID in February or March last year, it's been a steep learning curve for all of us, hasn't it? Because in February or March last year, people were saying to me, oh, it's a bit like SARS and we dealt with that. Well, it's a bit like flu and we deal with that every year. And, we know how to treat pneumonias. This is not a pneumonia. And maybe it doesn't spread very seriously from person to person, so we'll probably be okay. And this is all a bit alarmist. And, if you move on from there, we've all had to learn an awful lot about it. It really is a very, kind of insidious, deceitful virus that does weird things when you least expect it. And every time we thought we had certainty about different aspects of it, we turned out to be wrong and had to rethink and regroup. It was far more transmissible than we thought. So we know that whenever it finds a cell in the human body that has this receptor on it, the ACE2 receptor, which is especially in your lungs, but also in your blood vessels, in your kidneys, and all over the place in your body, it can get in and can do damage, which is why you see such a kind of diverse array of symptoms in COVID. The bit that's been hard to narrate, it's taken a bit of time, is how the range of symptoms could be so diverse. And if you catch it, you don't know which person you're going to be. Am I going to be one of the lucky ones who gets it more or less asymptomatically? Am I going to be the one who kind of lies under the duvet for a week feeling like death and then, carries on with my life? Am I going to be the one where I've got such an intense pneumonia that within 7 or 8 days, my, oxygen saturation has fallen from 98-99% to 80-82%, and I feel like I can't breathe and I'm turning blue and I'm, you know, ambulance to hospital, where I either make it or I don't? Or am I going to be one of the ones who gets through and survives but comes out with long COVID and, you know, wondering when am I going to feel normal again? You know, how could there be this incredibly diverse array of outcomes? And, you know, a lot of that is diversity of immune response. So, you know, for example, when we look at those severe events in the lung, some of that is lots of inflammatory cells getting into the lung and, you know, doing you damage.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's quite incredible how we have this vast response. And is that in part because of the particular receptor site that this virus enters the cell via? So the ACE2 receptor that you just mentioned there, that's present in the blood and in lungs and intestines. Is that the reason why we're seeing this multimodal, so this plethora of different symptoms?
So one of the illuminating things quite early on, so when you know, if you go back to this time last year, when papers were coming out thick and fast, particularly out of Wuhan and then out of Italy, I was absolutely obsessively reading them, you know, every hour of every day, because everything in it was surprising. And if you look at those early papers from Wuhan, there were people who didn't, in ways that we would think of influenza and things like that, they didn't look explicitly at first glance ill yet. And yet when they did CT scans of their body, of their heart, of their lungs, there was immense damage going on. You know, so this was a really nasty virus for getting into, you know, getting into cells, getting into places and, you know, doing damage.
Yeah. I remember during the first wave when I was working in ITU and helping out some of my colleagues there, exactly as I generally work in A&E, the CTs that we were looking at were just horrific. And there was a clear, before I think it permeated into public knowledge, there was definitely a clear recognition that this was a disease that was related to clots and sticky blood. It was quite frightening because we saw PEs, we saw strokes, we saw a lot of that. So there was definitely something like that going on. And we're going to get to long COVID in a second, but I wonder if we could talk to this whole process of the inflammasome and the cytokine storm. What do those terms actually mean from an immunological perspective?
Well, let's start with the inflammasome. So you can think of the inflammasome as a kind of innate activation cassette of all of the early defenses that need to be turned on to protect you against invasion. And that's a big part of our antiviral immunity. I feel like sort of COVID kind of does a double whammy on us, doesn't it? Because on the one hand, there's this kind of hyperactivation of the inflammasome so that lots of inflammatory things are going wrong. On the other hand, like a lot of the viruses in its family, like the common cold viruses, the, you know, the human coronaviruses, it's actually very subversive. It's very good at subverting and turning off bits of the innate immune response, what are called, you know, the type 1 interferons, that ought to stop it getting into cells. So it's very sneaky. So you've both got too little and too much immunity all at the same time. And then leading into that, cytokine, just obviously it's just, you know, the jargon for the sort of molecular mediators that come out of white blood cells. You can think about them almost like hormones that sort of travel around the body and make stuff happen. So obviously there, if you've got too much of the very inflammatory ones coming out, that's not good news. So, you know, so one of the ones we heard about very early on was interleukin 6, thus leading into tocilizumab, one of the antibodies that blocks it, has been sort of fairly successful. You know, this is a virus where, you know, some of us are dogged some of the time by too little immunity and sometimes by too much of the wrong sort.
It's quite interesting because a lot of people were drawing parallels between this pandemic and the Spanish influenza as well. There were clear differences there, right? So the Spanish influenza, it seemed to impact those who had robust immune systems more. Am I right in saying that? Or
if you go back and look at the ancient, you know, Lancet papers and things from the Spanish flu from those days, they're to some extent sort of similarly terrifying in terms of, you know, those incredibly kind of exuberant inflammatory responses they're showing in the lung that must have been like in a slightly different but really horrific way to die. And yeah. You know, there is some resonance there, isn't there? If you look at the kind of CT scans that you were talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about long COVID. So it's a term I think that's being used quite often in the media. Certainly over the last couple of months, I keep on hearing it popping up, and which is what's prompted me to do a podcast on this and actually discuss it in a bit more detail. What do we know about long COVID at the moment, and what does that term actually mean?
Interesting situation, isn't it? That almost everything we know about long COVID has been patient-led. So I feel like the medical profession has contributed surprisingly little to this textbook chapter so far, apart from, you know, some colleagues actually sort of dragging their feet, kicking and screaming against the very existence of the textbook chapter. So, you know, all power to the long COVID groups, you know, all over the world, particularly in Italy and the UK, and then, you know, places like sort of body politic as well, across the US. And they were the ones, you know, using 21st century social media platforms and coming out and saying, we're all describing the same thing. We're all describing a phenomenon whereby we know we had COVID, even if we had COVID at a time when you couldn't access a PCR test or you couldn't access an antibody test because we had the symptoms. And life has never been the same afterwards. And high on their list, they describe fatigue, you know, the fact that these very often were young or middle-aged active people who were walking and running and cycling and doing a full-time job who now feel, you know, that they're at sort of, you know, quarter or a tenth of their former speed. And they describe cognitive symptoms, brain fog and memory loss. And they describe wheezing and breathlessness and chest pain and joint pain and rashes, and you know, this so isn't in people's imagination because it's you know, convergent accounts from different countries around the world. It's very validated across very, you know, very, very large studies and surveys and publications now. It's a real thing.
To define whether someone's got prolonged symptoms of COVID, i.e. post-viral infection, you have to sort of decide what is defined as full recovery from COVID. So how do we know that you're fully recovered? I'll give you an example. I mean, I had COVID at the start of the year, most likely contracted from the hospital. After 10 days, I was fully recovered. But actually, I probably had prolonged symptoms for a week thereafter, whether it's because I wasn't allowed to go out and exercise and I lost a bit of exercise tolerance, or whether it was genuine prolonged symptoms of COVID post-infection. I'm not too sure, but I feel absolutely fine now and I don't have any residual effects. But I haven't come across a clear definition of full recovery from COVID thus far.
Yeah, so I think the simple answer to your question is that we really, really need one. And there's different, there's some quite learned people who've, you know, written, you know, for example, pieces in the BMJ and in the NICE guidelines to try and put down some markers for, you know, number of symptoms at 3 weeks or more. But, you know, we really need it for obviously for many reasons, because, you know, we can't count the cases and treat the cases and refer the cases unless we know what we're counting and what our kind of threshold is for being alarmed. And I think it's been a real issue and a real confounder, hasn't it? Because right at the beginning, many of my colleagues were very skeptical and still are, and dismissive and, you know, want everybody to be as you were and say, well, you know, you're bound to feel a bit dodgy after you've had a viral infection. You know, you'll get over it. How dodgy is dodgy, and how dodgy do you have to be for how long to think, well, actually, I'm not getting over this? And I don't know about you, but many of the people I meet and talk to with long COVID, you know, are very kind of, you know, robust, hardworking individuals who aren't just putting it on and really feel devastated that they, you know, 6, 9, and 12 months out, they still feel bad and, you know, completely underpowered and completely unwell and completely symptomatic. But I think it's very, it's almost antagonistic to some people to try and count long COVID, because how do you have a single diagnosis that lumps in somebody who still can't exercise as well as they formerly could 3 or 4 or 5 weeks after their acute attack, with somebody who 9 months after their acute attack feels like they can't go out without taking a wheelchair with them.
Yeah.
It was very sobering for me. One of my interactions was with a researcher from Radio 4, and Radio 4 were doing a program on long COVID and were very keen on the counting of it. And this chap got absolutely furious with me because I was quoting the Office for National Statistics data on at least 10% of all COVID sufferers having long COVID, which would put the UK, for example, at what, you know, 500,000 people with long COVID, and would certainly have implications for NHS provision, expenditure, et cetera. He got absolutely furious with me and said, come off it. You're not telling me that 10 or 20% of the population are in wheelchairs. We'd have noticed that. And I'm not, because it's much more complex than that, because there's people coming into that disease space, and there's people leaving that disease space and recovering. And there's some of the 3 weekers and some of the 3 monthers and some of the 12 monthers. And it's a very, you know, it takes very complex maths to model and count that. But it's there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry you had that interaction live as well. If it was on Radio 4. But yeah, I think to your point, you know, it's a spectrum. People will have prolonged conditions or symptoms, which might be classed as, you know, quote unquote, mild, versus those who literally can't get out of bed. And I think it's really important to distinguish that there is a spectrum. And I came across in my research for this podcast, there was this meta-analysis in January that you probably come across yourself, of the 50 odd symptoms that range from fatigue, headache, which I think are the most common ones, all the way to, you know, profound palpitations and some psychological elements as well. But it's certainly more of the physiological symptoms that you can certainly measure. I think it also, and to your earlier point, it speaks to a grave issue within medicine itself, of diagnostic uncertainty and how we deal with that as clinicians. Because, you know, I saw a whole bunch of people, I was working in A&E yesterday, and I would say probably a third of people who were well enough to go home, I don't have certainty on their diagnosis. And it's quite a difficult conversation to have with someone when you don't know 100%, because you're trying to be the authoritarian doctor figure, right? I think that's a bit of a cultural thing that needs to change within medicine itself too.
Well, you know, I wish it would, and I wish it could. I fear sometimes that we're kind of moving in the opposite direction, not in the direction you want to go. but, you know, all I can say, you know, in terms of, you know, long COVID, that, you know, we're all on the same team, aren't we? We all wish that we had more diagnostic certainty. And the only way to get more diagnostic certainty is to get, you know, better biomarkers, better tests, and, you know, just you know, better diagnostic criteria out there, which is doable. But it's only doable if we start to do the correct investigations. And, you know, again, you know, I mentioned before how kind of impatient we'd become over the last year for medical breakthroughs and how fast we'd learned everything. So, you know, why should we be surprised that a condition that we hadn't thought about till 9 or 10 months ago, we still don't really know what it's caused by, how to diagnose it, how to treat it. In some ways, you could say, well, you know, why should we? And yet, for those millions of people out there in the world, they're really impatient for this.
Do we have any idea of the potential mechanisms behind this post-viral syndrome with long COVID?
Well, you know, there are hypotheses out there, and, you know, like other people, we're kind of champing at the bit to analyze them and try and get some answers. And I'm hoping that this week we'll have our final ethical approval through to start doing investigations with people in the community, not just with hospitalized cases. Because if I was trying to list my favorite hypotheses in no particular order, I'd say that this is a virus that likes getting into cells around the body that have ACE2 on them. And it's quite a damaging virus that causes, you know, scarring, fibrosis, and leaves damage in those organs that you can see on a CT scan. So if you've got a damaged heart or liver or lungs or kidney, why shouldn't you feel ill? So I'm interested in that one. For me, the only counter argument to that one is if it was simply that one, you'd say there should be a very strong correlation between how ill you were and how hospitalized you were for how long and how much long COVID you have afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I'm not convinced that's the case at all. Or you could say, well, maybe it's a bit like other viruses like Epstein-Barr virus or cytomegalovirus or something, which kind of completely, you know, disrupts and perturbs your immune system so that all your subsets go haywire. And, you know, you just haven't got a normal immune system until it kind of resets a set point again some years later, you know, and that might be 1 or 2 or 3 years later, depending on how badly you do. Then I'm quite interested in the idea that a lot of people in the community have that maybe it is a reservoir of lingering virus that's doing you harm. We know that people have found lingering SARS-CoV-2 both in gut biopsies and in stool samples. So why couldn't it be that? And that would speak to all the people out there doing surveys at this very moment saying, you know, did I get better or worse after my COVID vaccination? And I think the I got better people are kind of quite far in the lead at the moment. So that would be interesting to me, that maybe it just took a really amazing vaccine to, you know, to boost up those antibody levels and clear that reservoir. So that's really fascinating. And as a kind of, you know, immunologist who spent most of my life also worrying about autoimmune diseases, I'm quite interested in the idea, for which there's lots of evidence, that it's one of those viruses that can set up a full-blown autoimmune disease. In other words, antibodies, you know, against bits of your body, a bit like, you know, chikungunya virus does or Ebola virus does, that you actually start out with a full-blown autoimmune attack. So all of those hypotheses, I think, are up for investigation. And we and other people are sort of dying to sort that out over the next, you know, 3 months, 4 months.
It's interesting to see if whether there would be any parallels between other post-viral symptoms, syndromes, like you just mentioned there, like EBV and Ebola as well. Is there evidence to suggest that there is that issue around autoimmune conditions being set off by the virus itself, like viral arthralgias, like rheumatoid arthritis, that kind of stuff?
One of the viral infections where we know the most about it is another one that that my lab is very keen on and works on in Brazil, called chikungunya virus. So chikungunya is one of the ones where the little mosquitoes there, they have the Aedes aegypti, nip you, and, you know, you either, depending on the season and the year, you either get Zika or dengue or chikungunya or yellow fever virus. And if it's chikungunya, you'll get one of those kind of, you know, sort of fevers and rashes and things, and sort of bad headaches. And if you're lucky, you might be better after 7 or 8 days. But if you're one of the 30 or 40%, you go on to get, you know, a full-blown disabling arthritis that could last 3 or 4 or 5 years. That, you know, that looks just like any arthritis, and, you know, and that becomes far more devastating to the sufferers and the economy and the healthcare system than the viral infection itself. So, you know, you can see why I bring it up quite a lot in this context. And that's led us and other people to think about that kind of analysis in COVID. And there've been 2 or 3 preprints so far where people have screened people after COVID-19 infection for new repertoires of antibodies against their own tissues, and found loads of them, just loads and loads of them.
Wow. That's quite scary.
Scary and amazing and interesting. But, you know, it is what it is. But it's interesting for an immunologist because obviously immunology has come on in leaps and bounds in the clinic in the last 10, 20 years. So when you see immunological problems, at least you have some immunological solutions, because there's so many goodies in the larder of ways of treating autoimmune diseases now, in terms of all the sort of biologics out there. But if we could only nail down what the problems are, I feel like we'd have, you know, good stuff to offer.
Yeah. And you mentioned it earlier, but using perhaps conservative estimates, how many people do you think this post-viral issue could affect, using the data that we have available to us at the moment?
Well, that's the question I'm scared to answer, because people at BBC Radio 4 shout at me when I say anything. So I'll say it with lots of sort of caveats and trepidation. I think conservatively at the moment, there probably are 500,000 people in the UK with long COVID at some kind of level. And I say that, you know, with lots of caution, because I don't know how many of those are the ones who described themselves in the past tense as having long COVID, and 3 or 4 months in are now, you know, bicycling on their bikes again and you know, looking after their kids and doing their stuff, and how many aren't. But yeah. I do think it's in that ballpark. And, you know, that ballpark clearly to anybody should be scary, because that's a lot of misery and a lot of jobs and families in jeopardy, and a lot of, you know, billions of pounds of NHS provision needed, and a lot of extra doctors needed, and a lot of extra clinics needed. So, you know, it's kind of food for thought.
Yeah, it really is. And I think this kind of brings me to the question, which I know is going to be very hard to answer, but theoretically, and perhaps even lending on your experience and knowledge around the gut microbiota, are there any things that people can do today to mitigate against any potential post-viral syndromes, whether it be diet, lifestyle related, or otherwise?
Yeah, I think that's really hard for me to answer, because I'd only be giving you know, secondhand information that's come out of the groups themselves, who really have done all of the running on this. So I know that there's a lot of anecdote out there, and something's more favoured and something's less favoured. And there are people looking at diet, and there are people looking at graded exercise and physiotherapy. So, you know, I'm in no position to give any kind of critical judgment on any of those, because I haven't sort of tried them or seen any of the data. But, you know, without kind of poo-pooing anybody's anecdotes or research, I just think those are kind of slim pickings compared to just, you know, doing the peer-reviewed research, getting some mechanism, getting some answers, and working from there. Because that's the world they come from.
Yeah, absolutely. And out of the other post-viral syndromes that we know of and have had experience with, what appears to work from that perspective? Is it, like you say, clearing, or it depends on the mechanism, but clearing the virus, let's say, with adequate vaccination, or?
Yes, you know, if you took those four hypotheses I talked about, well, okay, you know, if there's sort of fibrosis or scarring on your lungs or whatever, the answer is that that hopefully time will heal it. But if we're talking about you know, virus hanging around, its antivirals and vaccination, if we're talking about autoimmunity, you know, depending on the sort of minutiae and the details of what mechanism of autoimmunity, if you look at, you know, treatments nowadays for people with, you know, rheumatoid arthritis or multiple sclerosis or irritable bowel disease or whatever, there are so many different goodies out there that are, you know, that are doing them quite a lot of good, that, you know, that there will be and would be answers. So we've just got to kind of work it out and tease it apart.
Yeah, absolutely. And to do with the vaccine and the variants, so we have a vaccine at the moment. It's an incredible, you know, feat of science and collaboration across the world. How are we keeping up with variants that are to be expected to occur over the next year or so? I think people are sort of, and I think this feeds into vaccine hesitancy a lot from what I hear on the front line from patients that I deal with as well. How do we keep up with variants as we progress through this pandemic?
Yeah. Well, let me do you kind of 2 or 3 minutes of sort of my my current sort of state of play in my head about the variants. So sort of point number one to me is that, you know, we do across the world have this amazing vaccine program that's panned out so much better than I ever dreamt of. As in, as much as I describe it as, you know, a sort of ghastly and horrific and audacious virus and things, it's actually been very tractable to some quite basic vaccinology. So anywhere in the world that they managed to find a way to express this spike antigen in a very stimulatory way, they've almost without exception come out with very potent vaccines that induce humongous levels of neutralizing antibodies and T cells that really do the trick in a glorious, glorious way. So, you know, so that's panned out so well. So, you know, answer number one from me is that the vaccines are amazing, and just grab anyone you're offered. And because they're so amazing, in the jargon, sort of, you know, neutralizing antibody levels in the thousands and tens of thousands, you know, higher than we've ever seen before, what it means to me is that when people give you scary data about how much less potent they are against the variants, even South African or Brazilian, and say they're sixfold down or tenfold down, sure, that's scary, but most people's vaccine responses are so huge and so protective that for many of us, you could probably drop a hundredfold and still be in the sort of safety zone. Yeah. So, so don't kind of like, you know, throw out the baby with the bathwater because, you know, it's never going to work because we've got variants out there. For most of us, most of the time, you know, we're still in the lead against the virus. So I think that. On the other hand, one of the things that bother me, one thing that bothers me is that in many parts of the world, including, you know, European mainland, not too far away, we've got quite a lot of vaccine hesitancy, quite slow vaccine rollout, and quite a lot of percolation of some of these quite scary mutant strains. So I worry that we need more vaccination faster, and I worry that I see some politicians trying to sort of nag us to book our holidays and go there, which I think at the moment would be a really daft thing to do. And really asking for trouble. And so all that leaves is, you know, what does the future hold? I think the future holds a few things. Sure, obviously there's work in progress to tweak and modernize, you know, second generation vaccines that can deal with the variants. And that's, you know, so doable and so easy and so going to work. And I know that some people got kind of conflated this with seasonal influenza vaccines and the idea that we might be revaccinating people every year in perpetuity. I probably don't see it like that because influenza is a much, much, much more variable family of viruses with far more ways of changing than this one has. And I think that the fact that we're seeing convergence of different mutations popping up sort of similarly around the world shows me that those are the kind of, those are the tricks that this virus has, it has up its sleeve to evade immunity, and there aren't an infinite number of them to come. Famous last words, I may be proved wrong. I don't think we'll be having this conversation in 20 years' time.
Yeah. You mentioned a couple of words that I wanted to pick up on, neutralizing antibodies in particular. So that was something that was demonstrated in the vaccine trials. Can you distinguish between neutralizing antibodies and antibodies that I think are being conflated in the press, especially when people believe themselves to have the right antibodies after having the COVID infection? And that might lead into people thinking that they don't need the vaccine.
When I talk about the B cells making the antibodies, and people will have heard a lot about antibody screening and public health England antibody testing, and do the antibodies wane with time, and how many people in the population have antibodies, that's a very simple measure of antibodies, which is all the antibodies in a person's blood at any given time, where if you took a plastic plate and stuck some COVID spike antigen to that plate, would bind to that plate. And that's a sort of, you know, quite useful, really rough and ready measure of, does this person have antibodies at the moment in their blood? Okay. And it's a kind of very, very distant cousin of the much fancier measure that I'm talking about, which is the small subset of all of those antibodies that really do the business. So when I say really do the business, it's a subset of them that are so targeted to the business end of the virus, what's called the RBD, the receptor binding domain. And it's that RBD that binds to ACE2 on your cells and gets into your cells and infects you. So if you're a person that's got loads of antibodies on board that are going to hang on to that RBD and stop it getting into your cells, you can't get infected. And so the assays to test for that are really quite fancy and quite demanding, and not that many people in the world do them well. We've been very lucky to collaborate with people who do them absolutely brilliantly. And if you measure those, that's what I was talking about. You get very excited, or I get very excited, because there are many people out there who've had the vaccine, who've got enormous levels of these neutralizing antibodies, and you could never, ever imagine them being susceptible to infection. But the levels that we're seeing in vaccinated people are, you know, 10, 100, 1,000 times greater than the levels we're seeing in people who just got infected and never got a vaccine. So if there's anybody out there who still believes in the kind of old version of the herd immunity argument, like, I had COVID, so I don't need the vaccine, no, just don't go there, because it's not the same level of immunity at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really glad that we clarified that, because, you know, if one of the mechanisms behind long COVID is in fact a lingering infection, then that's another reason why a vaccine which elicits such a significant response in neutralizing antibodies would be useful against reducing that risk.
Yeah, I think there'll be a lot of work published on that in coming weeks and months, including especially from the long COVID groups that I think will be quite persuasive.
Yeah, absolutely. Danny, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it, and I hope it's...
I enjoyed it. Great pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening to today's podcast. You can find all of this information and more, plus the links to some of Danny Altman's research on thedoctorskitchen.com. Sign up for the newsletter and you will get weekly recipes and inspiration for how to live a healthier, happier life. See you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.